The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
I'm going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Punkonomics, your weekly discussion show that talks about everything and a little bit more. Dr. Benjamin Balick is our host. I'm your co-host, Jesse Velez. And also, we have a guest here today, Felix Balick. I can't even speak today. Anyway, you guys can say hi. I'll get off the mic here.
So, hello. Usually, I'm not the first person to talk, but, you know.
Yeah, I'm rushing. I'll admit that, my brain is like a sieve, in the immortal words of Thomas Dolby. Remember them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that was cool. Like early electronica, you know?
I know. One of the things about Thomas Dolby is that he was very harshly criticized because people kept saying that he was all electronic. Mm. Well, he is a real musician.
Oh, yeah, he was playing instruments, but yeah, he was a studio engineer. He produced a lot of like hits of the 80s, but then did his own thing, right?
Right.
Very sophisticated studio engineer.
Incredible musician. But before we get on to this, I want to say, happy belated 420 for all you guys out there and gals.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know what 420 is, a bunch of high school students in California started that. They got together at 4:20 in the afternoon, and they started the whole event anyway. I don't want to say too much about it, which also coincides with Hitler's birthday.
That's right. I always like to freak out all my stoner students posting on Facebook by... Yeah. They're all like, 420, man.
Yeah,
like,
Hitler's birthday.
Are you celebrating Adolf Hitler's birthday?
The Führer.
They're like, no, what? So, cool.
We also have a call-in today,
yes,
right?
Yes, we do. We have a special guest today. And that was actually part of, I gotta say, I feel a mea culpa is in order since I always, harass you, Jesse, about Mac stuff and I stuff. And today my fanciest, fastest Uber Android phone that I've had for a few months finally got to the point. It got updated to Lollipop and got into a lag where it seemed like it was a phone from the 90s, and I had to factory reset, and all of a sudden I'm not quite sure. It will take me another hour of hard work to put everything back in place, so I had to struggle to find my ex-colleague and now a good online buddy, James Rivera, or Rovira, who we will call and try and put on the phone and talk about education overall, educational reform in general, a little bit more in the spirit of, you know, how do we make this industry exciting again.
Right.
And I've been discussing this with him for some time now, and I look forward to hearing his thoughts, and I know he also is trying to do stuff about it, not just talk about it. I'd like to think that I'm trying to do that myself. So that'll be cool. So Jesse's diligently trying to, you know, get this shoestring operation operating. And that's why I have my boy Felix here with us too, because he's an avid what should we say? What's it, proper adjective? A vociferous critic of some of the aspects of education.
Some.
I mean, you do well in school and stuff, so you've adapted. You're not coming from...
Hello.
It's a little like the, you know, when I...
Yes,
did all
hey,
the math
how you doing?
This
is Jesse Velez from the WPRK.
You have
to master
it before you can criticize
we're put
it.
On the
people
air here
will
real
say
soon.
That you're criticizing it just because you can't hack it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a big difference there.
I got him on the phone.
On the phone! And now
First try.
Now you gotta point the microphone in the general direction.
Yeah.
Of course, sadly, that means callers cannot call us in today, but that's life.
Right. Well, so you can always send your comments to punkonomics.org.
Right. Or tweet us at
Facebook. Not that I would respond, but
that's I diligently try and put all the necessary relevant information, like where to stream this, where to get podcasts, where to, you know, the Twitter, the Facebook, etc. on the punkonomics.org website. So with no further ado.
Yeah,
what's
we're
up,
on.
James?
Hello.
Good to have you. We can hear you.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
No, my pleasure. Listen, I mean, as I told you, we're going to see, my brain is working. I'm sure you'll stimulate it. You'll give it a kind of a distance CPR and it'll kind of spur it into semi action. And if not, we'll just have to defer to Felix, who has a nice fresh plastic brain here. Jesse is probably, just as bad as I am at this point. been a busy week. That's perhaps, I'm sure it'll come up. We have plenty of time. And, so why don't you just start by telling us, who you are, what you do, and eventually the whole idea of the education, stuff that you're launching.
So, okay, good. Yourself. Thank you. All right. I'm Dr. James Rivera. I teach English at Tiffin University in Tiffin, Ohio. My field is British Romanticism. My main figure is William Blake. I have a book out, Blake and Kierkegaard, Creation and Anxiety. I've been working in higher ed for maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 years now. And I've been looking at the way things have been going for higher ed in the United States. I'm really disturbed at what I'm seeing, as I'm sure many people are. And national discourse indicates a lot of displeasure with the direction that higher ed has been taking. So I came up with this organization I'm calling the Anazoa Project. Anazoa is based on a Greek word, Anna Zoanisi, which means rejuvenation. And the main idea is to rejuvenate higher ed, at least here in the United States. And I'm coming up with a model for a university in which students, and actually some states are considering this now. Students don't pay tuition up front. They pay back a percentage of their income over time. And so say 10% of their income per year for 10 years after graduation. And that means the cost of their degree will be equal to or based on a percentage of its value in the marketplace. So we're not charging high premiums for degrees, that don't help students move forward. And it also makes the college's future, income dependent upon the success of its graduates so that the college is focusing on building up successful students rather than just focusing on itself as an institution that exists for its own sake.
That's an interesting idea. Of course, I can already, let's jump in and it's going to be chaotic as it always is. And it kind of works out for
That's
us at
all
the
right.
end. So just feel free to get back on topic. I'm thinking it's a little scary. You know, I mean, while of course it sounds good, but the first thing that comes immediately to mind as a kind of institutional economist is like, wouldn't that a little bit like charter schools make the schools incentive to capture, well-connected rich kids, as best as possible?
Right.
Because
That's
we know
true.
That.
That could be a problem. The thing is, I mean, I'm looking at numbers here, okay? And of course, you know how numbers work, right?
The
numbers I'm looking at for national average cost to educate students in 2011, all right? One number was $68,000 a year for research universities. For a small bachelor's degree granting institution, it's about $28,000 a year, okay? Mm-hmm. In the 2011-2012 year, Rollins College's financial statement lists operating expenses at $112 million. And it had 6,158 students. So the cost per student is about $18,000 per student.
And that's okay. All everybody together, which of course is
these are big numbers, so it's kind of artificial.
Averages.
And of course, endowments, large portions of it are restricted, so you can't use it for operating expenses.
Right.
I mean, the real picture is much more complicated than this. But I'm just giving us just a big picture right now. The typical endowment pays out about 5%. So to cover, say, a cost of $28,000 per student, you need a $560 million endowment. Okay, assuming all of it could be used to cover operating expenses. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if you have how many colleges and universities in the United States have an endowment far in excess of that? You know, that would be for, say, 1,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, I think a lot of schools really don't need to charge tuition. All right. And let's say the school is actually in the business of being a school and not a sports camp. You know,
being a little radical.
And let's say that, you know, the only expenses that were justified were directly related to the education of the students with some amenities, but nothing like what we usually do.
Right. And for the, for the listeners, I mean, you have, just a quick comment is that overall there's been lots of criticism in the past, 10, 15 years, the cost of tuition going up, a lot
right.
of insecurities and flux in the business of higher education, and one of the keen observations is that the amount invested in further in faculty and what you're calling these core activities of the college, the things that go directly into the teaching, most expensively,
right.
obviously the faculty, and then of course the classrooms, etc., went up by a few percentage points, you know, typically less than 10, while the costs of administration have gone up by hundreds of percent, depending on institutions, 400, 500. So you do have that
right.
kind of a, and that's a lot, not just to high salaries of big administrators, which reflects the general picture of the economy, but also to a lot of lowly, low-paid, hard-working, small staffers and administrators that are tasked with a tremendous amount of these extra activities, semi-entertainment.
Right.
It's almost like a cruise ship a little bit, isn't it?
Right.
Entertain
right.
them and feed
you
them.
Know?
And
I mean, if the college can stay, if it starts out with a big enough endowment to stay afloat without being completely tuition-driven, now, I'd imagine, you know, one thing, absolutely draw the line in a model like this, nobody takes out any student loans, all right? That's why you pay back to the college.
Right.
Okay? No student loans. None for the parents, none for the student. Loans don't pay for education, except for what you're paying back to the college. And, you know, sorry, I'm losing track of my thought here. And if you have a big enough endowment to support it, mm-hmm. you won't need to worry about how much money your students have coming in. Okay?
Right.
The, you know, and that I think will make it more of an equalizing factor than what you have, which is competition for the richest students, mm-hmm. Even in state universities, you know? And the other thing that we're competing for is international students because they're full pay. They got to pay cash when they come in.
Right.
So they're like massive cash cows.
Right.
You know, but those would be the ones who can afford it. You know, if the university can cover its expenses with a big enough endowment, it doesn't need to charge tuition.
And some top schools recently famously have been doing it. But of course, again, these are schools that can afford that. And there was some concern
right.
also I was reading, about in current debates about these things, that there's a concern that these top rich already schools will then attract all the best students, given that they can offer free rides and,
right.
and better service.
Right. Well, I mean, there's always going to be a competition for the best students. I think that's in the nature of running a college.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is, of course, the longer you have to keep the student, the more expensive it is to educate them. And what's contributing to that problem is the demise of our high schools and the quality of high school education. You know, so students are coming into college increasingly less prepared to do college level work. So colleges need to keep them longer to educate them to be ready to enter the workforce. And, they only have 4 to 6 years to do it. So if a student is coming in, say, 4 years behind in their development and their math skills and their writing skills and their reading ability, how skilled a graduate are they going to be when they leave college?
Yeah.
And how long are they going to have to stay in college because they're starting out with remedial classes?
And
you know?
I can absolutely corroborate that.
So, I mean, how does this model work for lower-performing students? Well, I mean, you know, we would have to establish some kind of baseline of cost, and it will be in the college's interest to recruit as many high performing students as it can, right? But this being a new venture, I don't think that's all that we would get. And I think, you know, part of the problem that with higher ed is colleges are in such competition for students that they're recruiting students who really don't have a chance of succeeding, but they're still taking their loan money. You know,
a scandal,
at least
right?
With this model, they're not. If they don't succeed, they're not strapped down with loans.
There's just now a scandal, right? There's a massive suing by students in one of the four
law schools. Law schools in particular.
Right, and big case, which is actually interesting because given if the government is either what, I don't know which institution, I haven't looked at the details of it, but if indeed it is established in court that they do have a claim that the school misrepresented the product and the debt and basically misrepresented the deal offered, then they could come back and renege on their student loans legally because it was misrepresented.
Right.
So it might be an interesting precedent to stop this for-profit school racket based on the student debt.
Where it's very predominant right now is students that are coming out. They're actually suing their law schools because at one point or another they were under the impression that as soon as they came out they were going to be able to hold a job and pay their student loans back.
So
we have been seeing quite a bit of that. In particular, I've been curious about it because I'm looking into going to law school myself. It's oversaturated.
I blogged about law school, man.
It's over. 25% unemployment for lawyers now. I mean, and you know, there's much to. It's quite scary actually. Long term, this is not about the financial crisis, about whatever medium term crisis is. This is, seems like to be a big one. It's like, you know, you're a feudal serf in England in the 14th century, and it might be time for reevaluation.
The American Bar Association has collected employment figures on all the ABA law schools out there, put them all in a huge spreadsheet, and there's a link on their website, probably on the very front page. And so the schools that are producing the graduates who get the most jobs are being reported on now. You know, forget about rankings. Look at the top. If you're looking at law school, look at the top 25 schools that actually place their graduates in jobs.
Right.
And some of them you've never heard of. You know, the number one, the top 10 you have, but some of them I'm pretty sure you've never heard of. I think the last time I checked the list, number one was University of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's the problem. But suppose that there's a tuition model where we're not charging a fixed price, but the student only has to pay back 10% of their income.
Yeah.
Okay, so if the student is not successful, that's a loss for the college. But that also protects the student from how much loss they could take, on their degree. Like, how might law schools act differently if the percentage of the tuition that their students were being charged is based on their future income? The law schools were saying, this is how much we're going to make from these students based on where they get their job.
Yeah, it links the incentives definitely much better, especially because the reason why I kind of, I choked on it a little bit is that my concern that we are indeed promising different institutions in different ways, higher education, other whatever, we are promising go to school, do well in school, and you will have a secure, reasonably comfortable life, and possibly become a big success. And we're selling it on that point, and I find that not only is that not obvious at all, because education does not determine wealth, nor success, even having a job. This notion that I will go to school and that will improve my position in the labor market is pretty tenuous, very fundamentally. We need the jobs and then create the education to fill them. It doesn't, the educated people do not create jobs. That's, even in Chicago, they don't believe that anymore since good old Milton Friedman passed away, I should think. Even he, I think, retracted much of it in his later years.
Right.
It's a bit more complicated than that in Reagan-style supply side. But there's... And I'm concerned sometimes that we're, I hate to... Honesty is one of the bedrocks of a decent education, right? And sadly, I don't know if our ability to... We are going to restructure education to make it practical, to make it... To help you in the job market. I'm not sure that... how do I say it politely, that much of that discourse is driven by PR and not by actually people who are thinking about it well enough.
I mean, the educational sector doesn't determine the job market.
No.
You know, I mean, that all it can do is make you a player in whatever job market's there.
Right.
And it can't, of course, no college or university can guarantee a job. But of course, the name recognition on the degree also helps with your employment opportunities too, and your networking options. I mean,
if college graduates
aren't doing that well now, people with high school educations are doing even worse. So it's not like, you know, what's really got us in a bad position is there's no justification for saying you're better off without a college degree, except for a few very exceptional people.
Well, the crafts,
and at the same time, if you have a college degree, that's no guarantee of anything either.
Right. And it's lower than the recent statistics. One of the scariest things I saw, Corey posted it, Corey Carroll, decline in labor force participation of college graduates, 25-year-old. I mean, going down from the high 70s to the low 70s in the past few years. That's scary stuff.
Right, it is. It is.
That's a lost generation kind of number.
Yeah, I mean, and it is getting to the point where you need a college degree to get a job that only requires high school level education, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the quality of our high school education sucks so badly that's misleading. I teach a lot of freshmen, and they're around national average. And these kids aren't ready to go to the workforce, man.
Right. They
don't have the math skills. They don't have the writing skills. I mean, of course, there are, you know, the upper 10% of, or 20% even, of high school graduates probably could go straight into the workforce. But the majority of them need the additional education just to be able to function.
I even question that. I mean, in fact, I have a top student here in the studio who will tell us a little bit about it here in the moment, because he's definitely adapted to the system, so he knows how to play it.
Yeah, but you're talking about a top student. I'm talking about the majority of students.
Yeah, but even the top, beyond the basic skills, I would question even their ability to deal with managing a project, work individually and creatively, you know?
I mean, the
top students are geared with their highly structured environment, perhaps to work in those corporate world jobs that used to be plentiful in America in the 60s but not anymore. So even they, I find, are not quite ready. They might have some skills and knowledge and even content, depending on their backgrounds, or just be smart in many ways. But I'm not sure that the school had really prepared them for anything. So what do you think about this, Felix?
Right.
Well, in my opinion and in my experience, the biggest problem that has to be solved before anything else is that there's no enthusiasm for any kind of subject. People do English and do math because the teacher tells them to, not because they want to actually know something or get a good job or anything. Until college, we're really just not mature enough to understand where our life is going. We just need that time, and we need to be able to not only discover ourselves, but also discover what we really like, stuff like that, what kind of job we want to get.
Right.
I think, like, going to college helps with that, because it gives us an opportunity to, like, discuss with friends and colleagues and stuff just what's going to happen.
Well,
that's the goal.
To an extent, right. To an extent, it's better, but sometimes one wonders. Again, that's why I'm so balking at this notion that now institutions of higher education feel obliged to tell people that, come to us, give us probably a lot of money, and we will hook you up with a career. I think we have to consider, are we doing it? And if so, how exactly?
No college or university, well, very few can actually promise that. And you can't, of course, just talk about a college or a university as a whole, but individual programs within it. So if you have the math skills to be a chemical engineer, you could probably get almost guaranteed a pretty good job right out of college.
Right.
Right? But that's only true in a limited number of fields. And how many students college age students in America have the math skills to be a chemical engineer? Mm. You know, we're talking maybe 1 to 5%.
Right.
You know, I mean, the kids that knew the multiplication tables in first grade, you know, like Sheldon Cooper, so almost like them, not quite, but, you know, it's a very small percentage of our students are actually able to work at that level to do that particular kind of work, and that's why those jobs are in demand. So, you know, what we have to worry about is everyone else, and for everyone else, it's like rolling the dice. Now, so that's why I'm saying if we make the cost of college based on the student's income and not on some kind of fixed tuition rate coming in, and we don't allow them to go into debt, what that does is reduce the risk for the student. You know, and if we set the terms of their payment, 10% for 10 years, after 10 years of payments are done, they're still in their 30s. Yeah. You know, they can still buy a house.
It also aligns the incentives with the
25-year student loan debt, you know, coming out of grad school. Right. You might be retired before you pay it off.
Right.
So this just isn't working.
I'm not sure that the lobbyists will be the first to jump on board with your idea, by the way.
Right. Well, the Democrats, I don't know if you saw the news, but the Democrats came out with a headline yesterday on the Chronicle saying, one of their agenda items is debt-free college for everybody.
Yeah. And there it ends. But frankly, again, it's such a wonderful, you know, on this show you've heard me spew my stuff online, the stuff that I can't spew on the radio, so you can appreciate, but I mean, this is really such a class, because once again, the Democrats have been at the forefront of dismantling. I mean, at least there's wide agreement between everybody. And of course, the nice gestures like that, but when it comes to charter schools and core competencies, whatever, and Common Core and high risk testing, the lobbyists purchase equal shares in the parties.
Yeah, see, I mean, I'm imagining this not as a systemic solution, but as just trying to start another private university based on this model with a large enough endowment to float itself and educate its students without having to incur, you know, without requiring them to incur large amounts of debt.
Right, the low risk philosophy and the finance here would mesh very nice with my deep beliefs that education has to really be play. That in the sense precisely play of as low risk, just like animals, you know, play where you're not going to be killed, right? You can make a mistake and dust yourself off and try again.
Yeah, you know what? That's what college needs to be. Yeah. It needs to be a place where students can fail with consequences, but not life-defining consequences. Right. Like, there's a cushion, you know? It should be safer to fail in college so that you can get up and try again and do it right the next time, maybe.
Right, you know? Longer time if you need it.
I'm looking at the way colleges are run, and you were talking about the amount of spending moving up toward administration and away from faculty, you know, which is a disinvestment in the school's educational mission.
Right.
Okay. Now let me talk about the way, say, a for-profit, privately owned business might be run. Okay. A person, say, invents a new product, goes on the market, sells it. The difference between the cost of production and the money he brings in from sales or she brings in from sales, that's profit. The sole proprietor, the owner gets all that money. Okay. So the owner is motivated to keep expenses down, to bring in as much money as possible. And the whole purpose of bringing in money is to put more in his pocket or her pocket. Okay. Private industry. Now, whether you like that or not, fine. Okay. Mm-hmm. The problem is colleges and universities are supposed to be nonprofit. And they're being run on that for-profit model.
Absolutely.
Where the point is to bring as much money in as you can and move it up toward the top.
And even to clarify, even when they're non-profit, that's the thing. A non-profit is an accounting.
It's a non-profit being run like a for-profit.
Absolutely.
A non-profit business, on the other hand, what it should do is look at its operating budget, how much money it actually has to work with, and provide the best services it can within its budgetary constraints.
Mm-hmm.
That's how a nonprofit should be working. You know, so we have people from the business world coming in, taking over higher ed, thinking like for-profit business owners, and they're driving our educational system into the ground.
Yep.
Because they're not running it as a service industry, they're running it for themselves.
It's an inappropriate model, and it leads to many things along the lines also of the separation between the pedagogical, like we were saying, the pedagogical overarching philosophy, and I'm talking about how you envision the way the machine works. I'm not talking about philosophy in any esoteric term here.
Right,
and the administration of it, the business side of it, are out of sync. If you run it like a Walmart, well, you get
Walmart product.
You get Walmart product. Now, it might be great for some things, but it's not really great for education nor for the world. Workers employed in it. I would say that to you, when you put together that school and hire me, I hope. Not quitting my job, my day job yet.
Come on, man, if you want it. We just need the money to get this thing off the ground.
Faculty owned. It has to be faculty owned and managed. That's,
yeah.
I'm a big advocate of that. Because the incentives,
that's
a perfect way for capitalism to move forward into the 21st century.
Let me extend that model again. All right, so you imagine a person who designs his own product, engineers it, and maybe hires people to package it and market it, but that person is a person who did the initial design of the product, like a first Apple computer or whatever. Right, that's great, man. The person who comes up with that deserves to make money for their invention if they come up with something that good. But in a school, the people who design the product are faculty members, assuming that the product is actually education. Right, I know I'm talking crazy here, that the purpose of a university is to educate its students. All right, it makes my head spin. But let's imagine the purpose of a college or a university is actually to educate students. The people who design the educational product are faculty members. The people who convey the educational product to the students are faculty members. Okay?
Yeah.
You know, the people who should be owning and running the curriculum are faculty members, because that's what education is. It's the transmission of knowledge and skills and the development of abilities from people who have acquired them to people who are in the process of acquiring them. Okay, and it doesn't matter what field you're talking about. I was an electrician for 16 years.
Sure.
I had to work as a helper under journeyman electrician to learn the trade, because they had already gained that knowledge and they're passing it on to me. And that's how education works. So yeah, I think faculty members need to be on the board as a body.
To some extent, that was perhaps one of the key successes too, because in the best of colleges and universities, right, we have faculty governance. So to a differing degree, the faculty is deeply involved in managing all the education aspects of the college. And of course, that has also significantly been eroded in different places, and in many cases, tragically, and destructively.
That's
the person who knows what to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like in the 80s or 90s, the business community generally trusted faculty to educate students, and so they would provide financial oversight over our colleges and universities. And faculty did their jobs, all right? And that's the way it seemed to work until then. And then something changed, okay? I don't know what it was, but it seems like the business community no longer trusts faculty to educate students. And that's eroding faculty governance everywhere. And that's, since faculty are the ones who are transmitting this knowledge and helping develop these skills, that's eroding the quality of our education.
You know, I mean,
this is
a big, big theme, I think, in the general decline of our economy in general. I often only half jokingly say that I see a lot of parallels between America today and, Soviet communist economies in the past. And no, it's not that I think that President Obama is a socialist. I wish he was.
Right.
It would be
right.
Much better for all, including businesses. But, so that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that we used to make fun, in a sense, of the old communist countries, precisely that people couldn't flourish, couldn't innovate, couldn't invent new ideas, recombine, bring things to market, because you had all these heavy, powerful bureaucrats enjoying all the power and not really knowing what the hell they're talking about, because all they know is to play the bureaucratic game and stifling all the innovation, stifling the enthusiasm, and heavy-handedly, crushing the freedoms that we enjoyed in the West, right? And then, oh my God, what happened? This is the world in which we live in today, and it's in education to some extent. Maybe we're one of the last bastions where we're trying to resist this in some sense, but all over the economy, that is happening, with some notable exceptions, those are the successful companies. So, so indeed, this is not some kind of touchy-feely, hippie, progressive agenda. I see what you're saying here is the very pragmatic and a practical and business oriented, you want it to work like Google does, not like IBM did.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and that's the other thing too. But, speaking to what your son said about students not knowing what they want to pursue or maybe even why they would be in college or, what they want to do going forward. What I want to do is integrate business education with, the liberal arts and with the sciences. Okay, especially like the earth sciences and the life sciences.
Yes.
And I want to do that because I would like this school to produce, among other things, a new kind of business person. Hmm. Somebody who knows enough science to know that if you pump crap into the ground, it's going to come up in your groundwater. Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, right, I know.
And if it does, it's going to make you sick.
Right.
Or maybe, destabilize things and cause earthquakes.
It's much easier though to pay lobbyists to shut it up and to do PR campaign than to drink bottled water, isn't it? You have to laugh and start
wherever
crying.
Wherever that comes from, right? Yeah. And not just environmental responsibility, but an awareness that, we coexist in multiple environments at once. We live in a technological environment. I mean, I have a couple computer screens. I'm on a cell phone, and I got an iPad next to me. And we live in a social environment that's comprehended by and represented by the arts and humanities. And we live in an economic environment, and we live in a physical environment. So because everything that we do, works in these four environments at once, we should be educated in them all and see how they work together.
Right. Yeah, interdisciplinarity, transdisciplinarity, the trendy word. It's a good word, though, right? When you combine multiple disciplines, not only do you just have, here's a bit of economics, here's a bit of literature, here's a bit of science or what have you, here's a bit of business, but actually when you combine them, you get a synergy, right? So that you actually see things that none of the disciplines individually and in isolation can see. Working in teams. Again, this reminds me of how tech companies work, where there's not department that does this in another department, but teams in which you have people with different expertise constantly collaborating. It's one of the reasons why the best education the smart kids have today is playing, online, massive multiplayer games. Better education than they get in schools, typically.
Those work. I've seen those. I recently read an article, I peer-reviewed an article about a woman using those kind of games to teach literature.
Right.
And because those games are basically narrative structures, right? I mean, so suppose you built a game based on this novel, and you create the characters with these attributes, and you have to figure out how to interact with them. Suddenly you're interacting with the world of the novel.
Yeah, my wife's actually in humanities, and we've just, we're publishing our third article right now. Just updated my CV yesterday. A little bit about that sort of thing, where we're using these environments, and the narrative quality of these games is an important aspect in which, that plays a lot. This speaks a little bit to, I'm very intrigued, and we can get back to this notion of how to structure the very operating fundamentals of an educational institute, and this kind of notion that you get that low risk in funding that you've proposed with paying back depending on what kind of career you succeed in. I think it also does a very big, it's very interesting to me in aligning the incentives of the management of the school, hopefully worker or managed, but even if it's not, better with the customer, yeah. But also, part of the invigoration, I think, is very fundamentally in the changing the, I'll say fundamentally again, even if it's bad English. I'm about, you know, speaking with an English professor, I feel a little self-conscious. Right? I'm an economist. I'm supposed to be one syllabide, you know. Not forgetting that there is need to change the very fundamental pedagogy too, and adapt
right.
it. It's woefully outdated, and I very much, in fact, again, I write about this too, that I understand the skepticism that many faculty actually have about a lot of the technological stuff that I find is very useful, because they're paranoid, right? They're always thinking, oh, this is some kind of cost-cutting scheme by the managers, by the administration, by the trustees,
yeah,
or whoever.
It often is.
Well, it often is, right. It often is.
Yeah, well, I mean, the last podcast I was interviewed for, we talked about technology in higher ed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to quit talking about technology in higher ed as a big subject, as if it was just one thing. You know, I think we need to evaluate every single individual instance of our uses of technology in higher ed and see what's effective and what's not. Okay. Now, I think it's absolutely essential that students read, and they read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because that's this, and there's brain research supporting this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. This is the way it develops your brain. That doesn't mean that reading is the only thing that they need to do. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think it's essential that students write, and they write a lot. But I don't think that, and then again, it's for just for the sake of brain development, cognitive development, but that's not the only thing that they need to do. You know?
Right.
So I think our pedagogies have to be multifaceted. I think they need to incorporate traditional elements of, you know, reading and writing, you know, and math, just knowing how to do the math.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, the focus on technology, you know, is often very misleading, because indeed it is kind of instrumentalist, right? So people are finding, you know, looking at the tools and finding a way to apply them. Well, precisely, I agree with you 100% that we're talking about pedagogy here. Now, if the technology should come in when it enables us to do more reading and writing, you know, or more conveniently, or above, often just adapt to the realities of the world in which we live. But they are precisely the secondary aspect, all this tech hype. The question is, how do you harness these very things? Just like, I don't know how the paper you read, but how do you get them to read can sometimes be, how do you get them to write? It's a tool serving these goals. So, for example, we do know that many of the smartest, most creative readers, writer kids out there today are what we lovingly call part of geekdom.
Right. No, they are. They're totally geeks, man.
And technology lives
they're
there.
They're the best students because they're enthusiasts. I don't care. I'm teaching a Sherlock Holmes class, co-teaching it with a fellow faculty member. We, at the end of the semester, we've had a lot of fun. And the best students in the class are the total Sherlock Holmes geeks, man.
Right, the BBC
series. They probably know more about the subject than I do. And it's because they've done the reading.
But then did you seduce them with the BBC series, and then, tell them, oh, but check out the original type of thing?
No, well, they're reading the entire Holmes canon from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
And they're watching all the BBC shows.
Right.
So they're doing, if they do the work, they're doing a lot of reading.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also seeing how that reading is being transformed into modern media.
Ah, you
know?
There you go.
Now, I think every student needs to learn how to use technology. You know, I would like all of our, you know, and in my ideal college, every student would have a year of calculus and a year of computer programming,
mm-hmm.
and no web technologies.
Yeah.
And at the end of every course, they develop some kind of project that engaged technology and require them to be creative,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think, you know, teaching students to be users, to be handlers of technology and not just passive recipients of technology, I think that's the best use of technology in higher ed.
Yeah. But it's sometimes, and you know, you're preaching to the choir here. It's just that sometimes I feel like
good.
I'm banging my head against the wall for years now about that.
Right.
And that's a bit of a, that's actually a painful point right there. It's difficult because they do not necessarily have the skills, and those skills are not fostered or not particularly. Yeah. And I, you know, much of this talk about the hype about, it's difficult. You know, here it is. It reminds me when I was interested in postmodern philosophy. And it was always was the beginning. The conversation was, yeah, I think it's really interesting, but disregard the 80% of it, which is bunk. So I feel I have to be apologetic. So same with technology and video games and everything. It's become so much of the hype that I have to say, yes, but there's pedagogy and there's background research. Though I'm still very much struggling with the notion of how to assess the quality of education.
Right.
That's a real biggie for me, which is another topic I thought I'd also, you know, launch here. I don't know. Maybe, you know what? Let's save that. That's a big one, I think. And I'm hoping to really learn something. So let's save that for the top of the hour. I mean, what about you, Felix? I mean, being like a teenager, like on your, are you like tweeting with your friends or something? Making fun of the old people?
Daddy, can you sound like any more geezerly if you tried?
I'm trying, yeah.
On the internet, tweeting with your friends?
Interwebs.
Daddy, please.
Tweeting. I am just so cool that, you know, I'm like, you know, you don't understand. I'm like post geek, you see? So I'm first generation, right? Respect your elders and, you know, so I'm kind of like the steampunk of geekiness, if you will.
Mm-hmm. As in, when you became a geek, they were still using steam.
Pretty much, man. Pretty much. Like, yeah, well, the first line of code I ever wrote was I had to write it onto a cardboard, piece of paper and stack it on next to the mainframe in a big state university. Line of basic, you know, like for the kids out there, like when you do standardized testing, right, SAT or whatever, when you have to fill in those ovals, how we had to fill in for every letter in the line of code, and every cardboard piece was one line. And the first video game I ever played was the Star Trek on printer on an IBM 360 in 1976. I believe it was invented in 75. But I was way out in the booties.
My dad had an Atari, man. I played Pong.
And Pong, oh, no, yeah, Atari, Pong. That's later, man. That's a later Pong. Absolutely. Of course, Pong and Atari. Yeah, I mean, it's museum pieces now, right? I wish I kept those things, you know? I kind of gave them away as old when I got a better system. My God, I wish I kept my Atari, my Pong, my, you know, my Apple IIc. Yeah.
Oh, I need to tell your son, man. That was a nice article you published there on the importance of space exploration.
Thank you.
I just read it today. That's good job.
Oh, nice, right? Yeah, he's
appreciate the argument you're making.
Right, it's an
thank
important
you.
One.
I got a good grade on it.
Yeah.
Good.
He's a star in English above all, and also biology and chemistry alike, right?
Yeah.
Those are the things.
Well,
that
biology was
right
last
now.
Year and next year.
Yeah, I'm saying globally, so anatomy, yeah. I mean, just broadly. But you like to write, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you never, you know, you always start writing novellas and stuff, but then he's always not sufficiently happy with his story, despite all encouragement that I tell him, no, this is good, keep going.
Well, right. I don't have the technique that needs work.
I would know, you know, I never could I never wrote creatively, so for me it's all like a
you can barely write mystery. Anything at all, Daddy, seriously.
See there.
No respect.
You want to see my CV?
I mean, Daddy,
I have a book, three book chapters.
If you know your work sucks, that means you have taste. All right, I mean, and you're able to exercise judgment. So, I mean, just keep writing, man. Just keep writing until you know it's good.
Yeah. Well,
but isn't it debilitating? I mean, in some sense, I mean, just get it out there type of thing?
I can't keep writing if it's crap.
It's not crap.
Right.
I can't write a chapter or two for something that I think is crap.
Well, every artist thinks his stuff is crap.
I know,
believe
but
it or not.
I want it to be... I want to actually have something to improve on.
But you have to lay that egg, you know? I wouldn't have my PhD now if I didn't at some point decide, is it good enough?
Yeah.
It's good enough.
Well, I mean, the goal is to start writing and to write through the crap until you reach something good. And then once you have a complete draft of something, that's when you go back and cut.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, it's, you know, the writing process is one thing, but the revising and the editing is where you really produce a good piece of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so don't be afraid. I mean, Annie Lamott has this essay called Shitty First Draft. And, you know, she says basically everything she writes starts out that way.
Yeah.
But it doesn't end up that way when she publishes it. You know, so, you know, don't let the badness of your writing stop you from writing. It just means you have to keep writing until you know it's good and then cut the bad stuff.
Yeah. I just hope to get some great writing.
Yeah, like stories, right? I mean, he wants to write, fantasy and sci-fi, and he's done some interesting stuff, actually, that I found to be quite promising. All I could say is maybe keep yourself maybe smaller so that you don't have to feel that you're building. You always start that kind of three-volume saga a little bit. Maybe that's making it difficult for you.
Well, I mean,
you can't be Ursula K. Le Guin, like, first try. You know what I mean? It takes
a... Yeah.
Okay, so we're top of the hour, so it's time for us to play some things. Don't go away. Let's do this and then pick it up right after.
Okay, you've been listening to Punkonomics here at WPRK Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Wellness College, and the best in basement radio. We'll be right back with some more Punkonomics.
Just a perfect day, drinks and gravy.